Clause number 13-20-77-CV in the matter of marriage of Ephraim Karsigi and Alyssa Lynn Karsigi and in the interest of EBK and AYK children. This is a transfer case from County Court at Law number 1, Brazos County. If anybody is watching live and is wondering why we're hearing a case that's not out of the original jurisdiction of the 13th Court of Appeals, this was transferred to us by the Texas Supreme Court. You may begin at any time, Mrs. Morey, when you are ready.
Justices, and may it please the court. My name is Kelly Morris, and I am here today on behalf of appellant Alyssa Karsigi. She was the respondent in the case below. This is an appeal from a suit affecting the parent-child relationship and dissolution of the marriage, but specifically we are appealing from the suit affecting the parent-child relationship and the possession order portion of the final decree. Specifically, the court below erred and or abused its discretion in two specific ways. First, the court committed reversible error in appointing Ephraim, the father and ex-husband, as parent sole managing conservator and Alyssa as parent possessory conservator when such an order does not conform to the pleadings, as neither party pleaded for Ephraim to be appointed sole managing conservator. And secondly, the court abused its discretion in entering a possession order that significantly and substantially differed from the model possession order promulgated by the Texas Family Code, which is presumed to be in the children's best interest. So as an initial matter in the party's briefing, Ephraim raised the issue that the issue of sole managing conservator was not preserved for appeal. So I wanted to address that immediately, so I'm sure that's on the top of your minds.
It is.
Alyssa moved for judgment notwithstanding the verdict on this very issue. While there was a jury verdict put to the jury on who should be appointed sole managing conservator, that is ultimately an issue for the court to determine. According to the Family Code, section 153.005, the court may appoint a sole managing conservator or may appoint joint managing conservators. As this is ultimately an issue for the court and not for the jury, error was properly preserved by raising it as a JNOV after trial before entry of final judgment. Moreover, to the extent that appellee alleges that this was tried by consent, I caution that trial by consent is an extreme finding. In Ray Walters, cited by appellee in its brief, states that the rule of trial by consent is limited to those exceptional cases where the parties clearly tried an unpled issue by consent. The rule should be applied cautiously, not in doubtful situations, and only where it appears from the record that the issue was actually tried, although not pled.
Are you arguing to this court that this issue was not tried to the court in light of the fact that it was made an issue during the trial? If my memory serves me correct from the record, the amicus attorney argued it. It was a discussion during both pre-trial and post-trial and during the charge conference. Do you not believe that was sufficient to put the issue in front of the trial court as trying it by consent?
Your Honor, I respectfully do not think that that amounted to trial by consent. A lot of the specific instances that are pointed to by appellee in the briefing are not pleading issues. They're not, what the parties put in their draft jury charge is not a pleading before the court when they're exchanged amongst the parties in an attempt to reach an agreement. One question in a witness examination does not amount to trial by consent. An amicus suggestions do not always match the pleadings and do not always amount to trial by consent. Moreover, here we had two competing theories of the case. Alyssa wanted to be sole managing conservator. Ephraim wanted to be joint. It would have been extremely confusing for the jury if they had tried to completely keep those two theories isolated. Say only Alyssa is up for sole, but, or you could have both of them as joint, but it would have required the submission of alternative questions, which would have done nothing more than confuse the jury, because this ultimately was a question for the court in appointing one or both of the parties as managing conservator. It didn't make sense to belabor the point at trial, and the strategy decision to do so doesn't amount to trial by consent.
But if your argument to this court is an extent of, that no objection was necessary because the question need not be asked to the jury, then the argument that this would have led to some type of confusion for the jury, again, leads us to believe that there should at least been some objection made or asked of the trial court, or told the trial court, you need to decide this issue before it goes to the jury because it's a legal issue, none of which occurred at the charge conference.
Your Honor, my best response to that is that objections are not required when they would be futile. And everything in the trial record up until the point of final judgment orders showed that this judge was not going to hear any challenges by Alyssa or her attorneys to how the case should be tried. The trial attorneys made the decision that because this was a legal issue, it was better off not dragging the jury into it. The trial judge is definitely, there's advisory jury verdicts on this and taking specific findings by the jury into effect. But at the end of the day, it's a decision for the trial court. And that was how the trial counsel decided to proceed. And I do not believe that that amounted to a waiver or amounted to trial by consent. Turning to the second issue, whether or not the possessory or the possession order that the court entered here that by and large is completely different from the family code suggested order was an abuse of discretion. In the divorce decree, the trial judge specifically stated that the deviation from the standard possession order is based on, quote, credible evidence that Alyssa Lynn Karsagi has a history or pattern of medical child abuse directed against the children. The court further finds that credible evidence has been presented that Alyssa Lynn Karsagi presented a potential risk of international abduction of the children by the parent. Therefore, or the court therefore finds that the following restrictions and limitations on respondents' possession of or access to the children are required to protect the best interest. There are two findings here that were made to support a best interest finding. While the later issued and backdated findings of fact and conclusions of law do spell out, they mirror the statute. They don't add new bases to these two specific facts that were found and issued in the final decree of divorce.
Can we give them, and I noticed that, there are the findings of fact as I bring them up, and I've got them on my laptop, so I'm not looking away from you other than my laptop's to my right, is that there's the findings of fact and conclusions of law are a lot more encompassing, a lot more expansion than what you just read to this court that was part of the record. But can't we take that into consideration in order to affirm the trial court's finding in this case, even though it wasn't part of that order?
Your Honor, yes, with the caveat that where the original order specifies a basis, the findings of facts and conclusions of law can't controvert that basis. They can be used to supplement and to further expound on the two specific reasons why there was a deviation from the standard possession order, but they shouldn't be read to constitute independent reasons to support deviation from the standard possession order.
So is that an abuse of discretion standard that we have to look at, if I'm correct?
Yes, Your Honor, although there's also a presumption built into the family code. So not only is it an abuse of discretion standard in weighing the evidence, but there must be sufficient evidence to overcome a presumption of best interest. And here the trial court gave us two specific reasons why she believed that deviation was in the child's best interest. So we turn to those specific reasons, which include medical child abuse and danger of international abduction. And quite frankly, there isn't sufficient evidence on either of those issues. I'm not going to stand here and dispute that there wasn't other evidence presented that the appellee cites to in his brief that could arguably go to her parenting. But when we turn to those specific issues, there is no evidence of medical child abuse, which is a different beast than what was briefed by the appellees. Medical child abuse is subjecting a child to medical procedures that harm the child. There has been zero evidence that any of the medical procedures were actually unnecessary. In fact, they were done at Texas Children's Hospital, which is arguably one of the best children's hospitals in the world, and that these harmed the children. And second, turning to medical, the risk of international adoption, there was a little bit of back and forth in the briefing here. There was a certify file that this added a new grounds. And to clarify, there is no argument here that the order was constituted additional measures needed to combat the risk of international adoption that would be found in the family code. We referenced that section as a basis of description, a definition for international child abduction. You can't just take a statute in a vacuum. So when the family code provides a definition of international child abduction, we should use it as a guiding principle. And here, none of the evidence that is cited by Appellee to show risk of international child abduction is actually a risk of international child abduction. Yes, there's testimony that Ms. Karsagi might need to leave, move somewhere else for a job, but there's no statements that she would move internationally. There's no statements that she has significant ties to an international community. The only person she knew in Jerusalem was her ex-husband, and he's now in Houston, and as the trial showed, he has ties to the community. Therefore, there was no evidence specifically of risk of international child abduction, which the trial court said in the final decree of divorce was the basis, was one of the two bases for deviating from the standard possession order. This issue was not waived. It's not a new issue that was raised for the first time on reply. This trial volume constituted, I think there was 20 something volumes of the record. In the opening brief, our position was that there was no evidence to support either of these. The appellee presented specific evidence that he contends were evidence of those two points. On the reply, appellants simply pointed to a statutory definition of international child abuse to frame the court's consideration. Because here there was no evidence of risk of international child abduction, and there was no risk of medical child abuse, the trial court abused its discretion in deviating from the standard possession order, which the legislature has deemed to be presumptively in the child's best interest. For this reason, and for the reason that the judgment does not conform to the pleadings, we respectfully request that the court reverse the trial court's decision and remand for further consideration.
Thank you, Ms. Morris. Okay, Mr. Swearingen, whenever you want to proceed, you may.
Thank you, Your Honor. The way this case was actually framed originally was that there was a failure on the part of the appellee Ephraim Karsagi to plead a request for sole managing conservatorship. I'm not sure that I totally agree that he did not plead it, although I will say that he did not use those words. And I understand this is a fine point, but when you are talking about a family law case in Texas, the pleading standards are greatly relaxed. And in fact, if you'll look at the case cited by the appellant in the matter of the marriage of Christensen, which cites a Texas Supreme Court case called Lighthold v. Ploss, it says the technical rules of pleadings and practice are of little importance in a family law case, since the overriding issue is the best interest of the children. And fair notice is afforded when the pleadings just generally enforce the court's jurisdiction over custody and control of the children. What it said is basically that the court then has decretal powers to address anything and all things that could be encompassed by that general pleading. The court should use its equitable powers, according to the Texas Supreme Court, to make sure that it makes a disposition of all matters that could be contemplated by even those general pleadings. Christensen was actually a case where there was no pleadings for a geographic restriction, and the court imposed a geographic restriction sua sponte, and that case went up on appeal based on the same basic issues. Oh, that was never pled. It wasn't pled by either party. This is all that was pled. And the Texarkana court came down and said they didn't need to plead it. Once you put custody before this court, every matter in custody is before this court. So I think that is an important issue in and of itself, even before we get into the consent issue. And I think Judge Benavides, you had a very good understanding or good points of memory of the record when we talked about N. Ray Walters and the things that the N. Ray Walters court found to be important in its determination that an issue was tried by consent. Because I think you see a lot of the exact same issues here. It was presented to the jury, by agreement. The competing jury charges
that Morris seems to make an argument this morning, Mr. Swearingen, that because it's a legal issue that needs to be decided by the court, that those issues, even though might have been critical to ascertain whether to try by consent or not, like a geographical restriction, because it goes to the jury, since this seems to be an issue for the judge, that those are not important at this point, and that the JONV that they filed was sufficient to, I guess, preserve the error that they had not waived it and or consented to it.
I do understand that. That is their argument. However, there's not going to be a case that I found anyway that would support that argument. In fact, there's in the cases cited, it actually addresses that point and said, we can't find any case at all where a post-trial motion of any nature would go back and cure an error of this nature. So in other words, I think that the consent issue is important and it remains there, even though you may want to call it an advisory opinion of the jury. I mean, this is a common issue presented to juries all the time. That's a pattern jury charge type issue. And so I think that not only by the presentation of the jury charge, but just by the way the case was tried, the pretrial summary that was submitted, it was just clear to the trial court that everybody and anybody was thinking sole managing conservatorship was an issue. And so I don't think it's limited to just that jury charge issue. I just think the jury charge issue is extremely important because I think once you let it go past that and then you try to pull it up in some post-trial motion, I don't think there's a case law to support that a post-trial motion can create that kind of reversible error. And that's my response to that particular issue.
Okay.
Moving on to the next issues. I think one of the things that the court addressed just a minute ago was the fact that there's not technically findings of fact and conclusions of the law in this case. These are findings in support of variation from the standard possession order that are specifically addressed by the family code. These aren't your normal text rules, civil procedure, findings of fact, conclusions of the law, that where the court lays out all its reasons for its verdict and things of that nature. These were specifically requested from the court as to why there was a deviation from a standard possession order. In other words, give us your findings as to why there was that deviation. And the court came back and said, well, here they are, and there's 20 of them. And truthfully, if we just look at some of them, we don't have to even consider all 20 of them because case law is very clear that there's certain types of findings that the court makes that those in and of themselves will support a deviation. And you can look at some of the cases that we cited on this. I think it's PRP or PCP or something like that. And the other case, Harrison, and those cases say, well, if the court makes a finding of mental illness, a parental alienation, failure to follow the order of a court to the detriment of a child, does anything that places a child at risk, that's in re PAC, I got the site here, or a factitious order imposed on another, disorder imposed on another, those things in and of themselves will allow the deviation. We didn't have to make this finding of...
Well, the question, though, becomes, in the initial order from the court, as I discussed with Ms. Morris, the court addresses the two specific ones about the medical and the leaving the country. And then we have these supplementals that were requested from the court. But if we start off with just those two and we don't pay attention to supplement, and let's assume for the sake of argument, there's nothing in the record to support what I will call number 7 and 8 as discussed in y'all's briefs. Can we then look, as I asked Ms. Morris, to the ones afterwards to supplement? If that's the trial court's initial finding and we say, well, there was no evidence of that. Yeah, now you thought of about a bunch of other ones. Can we take into account, or are we stuck with those two initial ones first before we can take into account what she calls the supplemental other findings?
Well, I think the issue, Judge, to me is the way that it's phrased now is not the way this case was structured, because what was requested initially of the trial court was not to make findings to support those two issues in your order. It was make findings to support your issues with regards to a deviation. And that was the way that appellant's lawyer requested the court. They didn't say, court, these two are wrong, and so let's address just those. They never expectly asked them to address those issues. They said, make findings of fact and conclusions of law with regards to these two issues. Tell us what you considered in the record that would support these two findings. And I do understand your question that since the court put these initial findings in, and then a supplement was requested, are we limited to just so too, or do the supplements come in? Well, I think because of the nature of a way an appeal is set up and has to be set up to be handled and to preserve error in certain ways, that it these findings would be incorporated in that order, because you had to, if you want to appeal an order, you can't just generally just go, I appeal that order. You've got to give the trial court an opportunity to correct whatever defect, if it can, before you take it up on appeal and challenge it. Otherwise, you're just kind of taking a secret card, put in your back pocket, and then you go, oh boy, watch, the court won't know to do this. And when they don't, I'll throw this out there and now we'll change everything. And I feel like that's what you have here. No complaint was made about this until now. And so I do think that, once again, let's go back to the structure of how an appeal is handled. Do you file a JNOV? Do you file a motion for new trial? Do you file a request for findings, fact, and conclusion of law? Do you file a request for findings? All of those things are precursors to get us to where we are today. And so I think by cause of that, all those types of post-trial findings are incorporated into the order itself. Or the reason for the order itself would be a better way to phrase that, I think.
Do you think there is testimony in the record, and I haven't, I haven't read all of it carefully. I've perused it all in order to get ready for today. But is there any record to support that there was a history of pattern of medical child abuse and or potential risk of international abduction?
I think there is, Judge. One thing I'd like to point out is in the brief, for the very first time, the appellant's brief, they cited some medical doctor who used his definition of medical abuse. That was not presented at trial. That person's never been vetted, never been subject to a Daubert challenge. There's not a case that was cited that said, this is the definition of Texas of medical child abuse. So that issue was not really challenged in the trial court. So, and then secondarily to that, you did have specific testimony by Dr. Kim Arredondo, who was a child custody evaluator. And she said that factitious disorder imposed on others, especially if it's a child, and in this nature time, it was a child and it was imposed on them, constitutes child abuse. And in the specific examples that are set forth in our brief, if you'll look at those, a lot of those are medical type issues, medical type procedures, medical type things that occurred to the children. So I think you have clear testimony that there was medical child abuse. And the fact that the way the children improved and the diagnoses were taken away and everything else when they were in the custody of my client instead. Also, you had the appellant's own child-appointed court ordered counselor Vanessa Watts also found that there was factitious disorder imposed on others, that that was a condition that her client suffered from. And if we read some of the things that she told the doctors about, they would say something about projectile vomiting, and she'd go, oh yeah, they're projectile vomiting, and just different things of that nature. It's clear that the child custody evaluator was concerned about the fact that she, she exaggerated, and she did a lot of other things with regard to, quote, the medical, alleged medical issues of the children.
Which, but you think that kind of testimony falls in line of with what the court found was the history of pattern of medical child abuse? Not that she was taking, as Ms. Morris indicated this morning, to get unnecessary medical treatment.
I think it was unnecessary medical treatment, yes, Judge. And okay. I think that's why it is medical child abuse. If you can read about the list of the procedures that the children were subjected to, and the average child never seen those in its entire childhood life. So I think that was an extremely important testimony from that perspective. And once again, that issue was never challenged until now. But anyway, the next one is there issues of for the court to consider about international abduction? And I'll concede that the major issues that were discussed were the abduction issue in and of itself. And I think the court's focus on the international abduction issue circled back around the fact of the very unique circumstances of these two children. They have dual citizenship. They have dual passports. The appellant herself had studied in Israel, got her degree from Israel, things of that nature. She obviously had an interest in the Hebrew culture and things of that nature based on her studies and things. And so I think that added an international flavor to it that was then supported by the abduction issue. And the abduction issue was clear in that she would speak Hebrew to the children in the supervised visits, even though she was told not to. She would call them by Hebrew names. She would bring in men that the children didn't know and try to introduce them to those men. A companion of hers drove through the parking lot of the supervised Fort Ringo and drove through that with the license plates removed from its vehicle and was photographing or videotaping the entranceways and exitways of that building. And that person was also associated with a woman whose name escapes me off the top of my head right this second. But she, in another case, was found to have abducted her own children. So you've got a lot of abduction type issues. I mean, people don't go around supervised facilities with no license plates on their cars and videotape them unless something funny is going on, in my opinion anyway. And I think the court was suspicious of those types of activities. And then when you combine that with, like I say, the international flavor of these particular children, then I think the international abduction issue is an issue. And that there were specific things the court heard in testimony and evidence that would lead it to conclude that that could be an issue. It's also the second time that the passports were restricted. In a previous proceeding, the magistrate court also restricted the passports in this case. So I think the passport issue has been an issue, and it was pled in a general sense by Mr. Karsagi, that he wanted not necessarily a restricted passport, but he wanted the sole ability to do certain things with regards to the American consulate and things of that nature.
Well, I thought that the passports had been turned over to the trial court. I don't remember why I saw that somewhere.
They were at one point in time, Judge, and then they were released to my client.
Okay.
Signing of the decree. The magistrate had put a State Department restriction on the passports at a temporary orders type hearing.
Okay.
And I think, Judge, like I say, I can list specific other factors that we, but they're in our brief and they're set out line by line, item by item. You'll see them, you know, 1 through 20 or whatever it is on each one of them. We've detailed those. Now, I'll say this, we weren't really challenged until the reply brief with looking at the issue of international abduction, that had really not been brought to our attention, that the court failed to make certain findings or do certain things. And so we did not argue that. We actually requested the court to let us file a SIR brief. And then in the SIR brief, we said, Judge, you shouldn't consider these things because they're just now raised for the first time in a reply brief. And if you're going to consider them, that we should be allowed to brief those if the court really, really wants to look at them. Once again, I don't think they're properly preserved to be before the court today anyway. So that's the court's determination to be made. But like I say, those issues, or the structure of those issues is what I should say, was not raised until in the reply brief when we didn't have an opportunity to respond.
I noted that.
I don't have anything really specifically else, Judge. I don't
know. I'll ask Justice Sahin or Justice Longoria, do you have anything follow up for Mr.
No.
All right. Then we will take our 2 minutes and 49 seconds back, Mr.
You can have them, Judge. Thank you.
Thank you. All right, Mrs. Morris. Let's begin back. I do want to address a quick point, even though I was trying to pull the pleadings, the last known pleadings on my computer. In light of the Christensen opinion, is there enough pled, one, in Mr. In the father's pleadings? And two, there is this discussion that we have had in family law cases, and I recently had a case in which this was discussed, in regards to pleadings being more open, not that the pleadings mean open, but once the issue is in front of the court, that the trial court then has jurisdiction to look a lot of things, even those things that aren't pled.
Respectfully, Your Honor, Appellee made several comments about how there's like a relaxed pleading standard in family law cases and how everything just kind of happens in family law cases and trial things come up and we accept that there's new things that come up at trial. And we accept that people may not be precise in their pleadings in family law cases. I would argue that this should be a case, the family law cases, particularly like this one, where a mother is stripped of her rights to see her children except for a few hours a month in a supervised setting, that we should hold parties to very strict standard of pleading. Not a made-up standard, but hold them to the letter of the law here and hold the court to the letter of the law and make the court adhere to these pleadings. The original divorce petition for divorce pled for joint managing conservatorship. My client, Alyssa, filed a counterclaim for divorce and for the first time introduced the idea of being the sole managing conservator.
Let's go back to what the trial court is based and it's not in your pleadings. It wasn't a big case, but this court recently wrote a case in the interest of JJ, where we talk about ultimately, since it's the trial court's best interest in the child, you know, then the court can take into account some things that necessarily, like if he finds, for example, I believe in that case, the issue was some violence as to the parties and the child. And so once the court decided there might be violence under the best interest, even no one had pled violence, he was able to take that into consideration, or she, I don't remember what it was at this point. So once we're at the best interest of the child, does that not trump, I guess, a pleadings problem? If the issue was brought in front of the court, I guess would be my question.
Your Honor, I don't think that is fair to these parents, to allow the trial judge to change the rules of the game at the end of the day. We attorneys rely on pleadings. We make our trial strategy based on what is pled, what discovery we've done. When we get in front of a jury, sometimes the issues get framed in different ways, but that doesn't mean that the entire rules of the game change. Most of litigation happens before the jury sits down. And to allow a trial judge, a family law judge, to significantly change what's at issue is really concerning. My client, frankly, was shocked at this verdict. She thought that there was a good chance she was going to come out being the sole managing conservator. And instead, she gets to see her children for a few hours a month, and then COVID hits and she doesn't get to see them at all. And so we have instances like this where the pleadings are so drastically different than the judgment that there has to be a line. Real quickly to address the deviation from the standard possession order, we keep talking about medical child abuse here. There's not a judgment in place that says that my client committed medical child abuse. That is a very loaded term. While Appellee has pointed to evidence of medical procedures and tests that are done, that once again, I'll remind the court, were done at Texas Children's Hospital, Meyer Center for Developmental Pediatrics, the best in the country. There was zero evidence at trial that the children were harmed in any ways, and that at the time these procedures were performed, that they were in fact unnecessary. There is evidence that the children have improved since then, which is great. We're all happy for the children. But there's no evidence that the procedures themselves, the tests themselves, were in fact unnecessary or in any way harmful to the children. Additionally, on the international child abuse, Mr. Swearingen referred to the international flavor of this lawsuit and my client's obsession, more or less, with the Hebrew language. My client converted to Orthodox Judaism. She met her husband at a Jewish university in Israel. They got married in the Orthodox Jewish faith. They moved to College Station and got ingrained in an Orthodox Jewish community. During her supervised visits, she prayed with her children, and those prayers are in Hebrew because they are, in fact, Orthodox Jewish people. She called the children by their Hebrew names. If this was any other faith, probably in any other part of the state, there wouldn't have been red flags raised by the supervisor about praying with her children and using their Hebrew names. That in and of itself is not evidence of international child abduction, which the judge in the divorce decree explicitly said was one of the two reasons for deviating from the standard possession order. International. And just because my client has learned Hebrew as part of her growing in faith does not mean that she's going to flee with the children. And just because she wants to pray with her children in Hebrew doesn't mean she's going to flee to Israel with her children. Giving Mr. Karsagi the right to control the passports is an issue that's not challenged. That's a wholly separate issue here. The question before the court was, the decision that the court made was that there was a risk of international child abduction, and there is no evidence to support that finding. Therefore, it's an abuse of discretion to do so. For both of these reasons, we respectfully request that the court reverse the judgment of the trial court and remand for further proceedings.
All right, Ms. Morris, is there anything further from Justice Tejerina or Justice Longoria?
No. No.
Then the case would be under submission at this time. Thank you very much for joining us by Zoom this afternoon.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you.